darkest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power. Green Lantern's light.
Welcome to Green Lantern's Light. This is episode 6, where we cover all of Green Lantern's adventures from the late pre-crisis era all the way through Crisis and beyond. I am one third of your trio of hosts, J. David Weider.
I'm Michael Bradley.
And I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And this week, Michael actually has a couple of announcements.
You want to tell him what we're covering this week before I do that?
I should probably do that. This week in our regular coverage, we are looking at Green Lantern 184, 185, and 186, as well as our first annual Tales of the Green Lantern Corps, annual number 1.
Yes. But first, we have a little bit of news to share. DC recently announced that in November, they will release Green Lantern, Sector 2814, Volume 1, Trade Paperback, which will collect Green Lantern issues 172 to 176, 178 to 183, and 185 and 186. That's all of the non-reprint issues of the monthly book that we've covered since episode 2, or will have covered by the end of this episode.
That's really cool.
Yes.
I didn't know that they were planning to do that. If only they'd planned it a few months earlier.
Well, I like to think that our podcast... Our famous podcast inspired them to collect the stories. But
we have weight.
Yes. Yeah.
We matter.
It doesn't say, but I doubt that that collects the backups, but those have already been collected in other volumes.
I am sincerely doubtful that that will collect the backups.
The retail cover price is going to be $16.99 and 192 pages, so that's not a bad deal.
No, that's not bad at all.
Hopefully they'll put out more volumes if it sells well enough. Cover the stories that we're going to
be covering. Out and buy it.
Yes.
That is endorsed by us.
I'm probably going to buy that one.
We're Green Lantern's Light, and we approve this message. We've also got an email to read. This comes from Brian Rosen, and he writes, "I'm happy to have stumbled upon this podcast. I was wondering if you're planning on reviewing the feature film, or even Green Lantern in TV cartoon episodes, such as the appearances in Superman the Animated Series or the 1960s Filmation short episodes."
Well, we have until 1998 till we have to deal with the appearance in Superman the Animated Series, and even longer until we get to the Justice League appearances.
Right. Yeah, I definitely want to touch on the Superman and Justice League cartoons when we get there in the regular coverage, but
it's just so long that I can't even fathom just yet.
Yeah. We did kind of talk about the movie last episode a little bit. It might be fun to do commentary on it at some point, but it'll be a while down the road before any of us have time to do it, I think.
Yeah, and I'll have to have some blood pressure pills in my system before I can do that.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a commentary together. I sort of temporarily abandoned the idea, but I do want to revisit it, doing a Superman Returns commentary with me, Michael Bailey, Scotty V, and Steve Yunus.
Oh, that'd be cool.
And that would actually tie into an article that I wanted to do for movies.com, which would essentially be where Superman Returns went wrong. Because I mean, there you have four people who really like the movie,
right,
but recognize that it has problems. So it wouldn't just be us trashing the movie the whole time. We'd be talking about the good things about it, but also mentioning that there were some things that could have been done better.
All right, so to get into the issues themselves, first up is Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Annual number 1, with a cover date of 1985 It was released October 4th, 1984, for a cover price of $1.25. And our cover artist is Gil Kane. And our story inside is 40 pages, and is titled Those Who Worship Evil's Might. It was reprinted in Tales of the Green Lantern Corps, Volume 2, trade paperback. Credits are Paul Kupperberg, plotter and co-scripter, Len Wein, co-scripter and editor, Gil Kane, illustrator, John Costanza, letterer, and Anthony Tolan, colorist. Green Lanterns Arcus Chemic, Tomar Ree, Aricia, Katmatui, Chip, and Zax prepare to leave Oa following the appointment of John Stewart as the new Green Lantern of Sector 2814. Katma is busy complaining about Hal when a quake strikes the planet. This catches the Lanterns by surprise because Oa is the most geologically stable planet in the universe, making earthquakes scientifically, and not to mention grammatically, impossible. At the prompting...
Sorry.
At the prompting of the Guardians, the six Lanterns fly into space to investigate, where they discover a white dwarf star fragment bombarding the planet. While Aricia attempts to hold back the fragment, Zax uses his ring to drill a hole through the planet, allowing the fragment to pass on its way safely. They then return to Oa to find the Guardians' citadel in ruins, and the Guardians lying in defeat. The Guardians explain that while the Lanterns were in space, they came under attack by an unknown force, which drained the central power battery and abducted three of the Guardians. Tomar Ree suggests mobilizing the entire Corps to rescue the abductees, but one of the Guardians says that with the central power battery drained, it can't charge the individual batteries, which means it's up to the six Lanterns on Oa who are the only ones with fully charged rings. Heading back into space, the Lanterns discover three distinct energy trails left by the abductor, and split into three pairs to follow each trail. Aricia and Tomar Ree follow their trail into the intimidating heart of a red giant, and then through an interdimensional portal where they discover the body of a Guardian lying still in the endless void of space. They start to approach, but suddenly the Guardian lifts his face and gazes at them with a menacing stare. Behind him, space itself seems to rip open, and a horde of alien monstrosities lunge towards the two lone Lanterns. Elsewhere, the Green Lantern of Krylos attempts to stop a band of pirate raiders, but his ring abruptly loses charge, causing him to fall towards the planet below. Meanwhile, Katma and Zax approach Narcos 11, where they receive a message from the Guardians telling them that they've been unable to pinpoint the being responsible, but that the abducted Guardians are being used as focal points for the stolen energy in order to break down the walls between dimensions. Katma and Zax continue to follow their trail down to Narcos and into a CD bar. They're forced to surrender their rings before entering, and after tangling with the locals, follow the energy trail to an upper floor and down a hallway to a sealed door. Zax is able to pick the lock and they enter, but are hit by a blinding flash of green light and one of the missing Guardians. A voice controlling the Guardian boasts about how he has them at his mercy, but Katma reveals that they never actually surrendered their rings, only ring-generated duplicates. The Lanterns clash with the energy generated by the Guardian as a portal behind him opens, revealing the silhouetted form of a beastly warrior, while eyes blazing red as an exploding star shine forth from the inky darkness. Another interlude shows Edor, or possibly Edor, I'm not sure, Green Lantern of Trant, falling to a similar fate as the Green Lantern of Krylos. We then cut to Elsewhere, where Arcus and Chip are following the third energy trail. A pair of sinister eyes pierces through the darkness of space as the dimensional walls start to fall. The Lanterns realize they need to act, but before they can, a blast of energy from the eyes hits Arcus, causing him to disappear and leaving Chip alone. Elsewhere, Tomar Ree and Aricia are holding their own, but making little progress against the horde of alien beasts. They notice the Guardian has grown to 10 times his normal size, and that a burning hole of emerald energy is forming in his chest. Aricia worries the Guardian will be killed, but Tomar Ree says he believes the hole is a time-space warp, and that they should enter. Back with Katma and Zax, the beastly warrior emerges from the portal. The Lanterns attack, and the creature starts to fall. They realize the creature must be tied to the portal's energies, and try to flood it with power from their rings in hopes of overloading it. Unfortunately, the bombardment is exactly what the creature wanted. And as this Guardian also starts to grow larger, the creature rises and declares that he is Maldor the Almighty, now free of his imprisonment in a dimension beyond time. Maldor begins to drain Katma and Zax's rings, as well as the rings of Green Lanterns across the universe, growing stronger and stronger as each lantern falls. We cut back to Chip, who is able to use his ring to force open the warp that snatched Arcus, and shortly after, he appears in the same place as Arcus, Aresia, and Tomar Ri. With the rings low on power and not responding to their commands, the lanterns decide to focus all their energies into Arcus's ring, allowing him to be the vessel for their remaining power. Back on Necros, Katma and Zax are faring poorly in their battle against Maldor. A flash of emerald light and Arcus, with the other lanterns in tow, comes through the portal in the captive guardian's chest. Katma and Zax join the lantern's chain of power, funneling the energy from all five lanterns into Arcus, who engages Maldor in a fierce battle. Arcus fights for all he's worth, but it's not enough. Despite wielding the power of six lanterns, he's unable to overcome Maldor, who is channeling the power of the rest of the Corps. Arcus realizes his only option is to steal Maldor's playbook, and begins to siphon off Maldor's power and into himself. But with the power of six lanterns already, his body can't retain that much power. With a scream, Arcus lunges and tackles Maldor. He grabs hold and continues to siphon his power away. And after a knowing smile of satisfaction to his compatriots, a flash of emerald energy explodes the scene, and a heartbeat later, both Maldor and Arcus are gone. As the lanterns hold back tears for their fallen friend, the Guardian returns to normal size and plucks Arcus's ring from the void. "He shall be missed," the Guardian says. "But he knew, as you all know, that he might one day be the object of our mourning. Arcus Chumuk was a noble being, and thus did not hesitate when that day came. His sacrifice was great, but as a Green Lantern, he could do no less. Our comrade will be remembered as his ring is passed to another, for in that way he shall live on, as long as there stands the Green Lantern Corps."
But it's a comic book, so he'll be back.
Yeah.
He got better.
I got better.
So who wants to go first on this one?
I will let Jeffrey go first, since I have very little.
That's fine. First off, of these six Green Lanterns, the only one that I'm really not familiar with is Zax. And my first thought was that if somebody's going to die in this issue, that it would be him, that he would be, you know, the red shirt guy. But that does not end up being the case, obviously. I was not expecting Arcus Chumuk to be the one who actually dies. Getting into pages 2 and 3, it goes to show that the ritual of recharging the ring is really important to the Green Lanterns. As much as that can come off being just a little bit cheesy, and it kind of is, like, hey, let's all go recharge our rings together. It still makes sense. It's very much like the military in that way. Like, let's do this together.
Yeah, it's
this thing that we all do. Yeah.
Kind of a moment of solidarity.
Yes, exactly. By page 4, we already went through why Cat Matui is mad at Hal for quitting, but I'm glad that it does get some mentioning instead of being glossed over or forgotten, whether it's here or in the issue that it happened in where he was quitting. It would be very easy to just not pay any attention to that and have her be, okay, bye, Hal.
Right.
Page 5, I love the Julia Schwartz Guardian. All the Guardians have the Julia Schwartz face.
I didn't really notice that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And they all have the nose. But that's very much him. And it's like that the whole way through, actually, but that's the first time we see him in this issue. Page 7, okay, a white dwarf fragment. That's really interesting, I think. A white dwarf, for anybody who might not be familiar, is supposed to be amazingly dense. A white dwarf star could have the same mass as our sun, but it's often closer to the size of Earth. So essentially a teaspoon of it could weigh tons and tons and tons. So a fragment of it would be a bit difficult to actually deal with. But I actually will return to that in a few pages. Moving on to page 11, this has got to be pretty freaky. The thought that the Green Lanterns, that their battery dies. And if the central battery is down, the individual ones are too. And that really is why it was such a big deal that the Green Lanterns went and recharged their rings when they did in the beginning. yes, they did the whole bonding experience that we were just talking about, but that they are the ones with the most charged rings, and therefore they are the ones who should go off and do this. Page 12, Into Infinity and Beyond. I just had to quote that.
That's in my note.
Yeah, of course it would be years later that Toy Story would come out, so there's no theft there or anything. I just find it really amusing anyway. Page 13 and 14. This is where I'm going to revisit the whole white dwarf thing, because they're going to go into a star. This is Tomar Ri and Aresia. The trail that they're following goes into a star, and Tomar Ri's like, no, you just got to concentrate, and you can go into that star. No. There are a lot of things that I'm willing to buy into about the power of what a Green Lantern ring can really give you, but the ability to fly into a star, I'm lost on that one.
Well, it's just willpower. They just have to have the will to do it.
They had such a hard time with a white dwarf fragment, and now they're going to go into an actual active star? And those things are plenty dense in and of themselves. But regardless, I've said as much as I really care to say about that, I just don't buy it. At least it went somewhere. Page 17, we have this interlude where it's a Green Lantern who is trying to fight off these space pirates, and then suddenly he loses the charge on his ring. Yeah, he's dead.
Yes.
Yep. So this guy's dead.
They don't come back to him.
Now, this deal with the dimensional barrier that sort of begins being talked about on page 18, I just find that kind of confusing, and I'm not clear on how that serves the story or why they can't just be in different parts of space. Because the universe is huge. They don't have to necessarily deal with other dimensions. But that's just me. That's entirely my thing. There's nothing actually wrong with the story because of it. Page 20. I had to guess. I guessed this while it was happening, that they constructed fake rings to hand over and really had their Green Lantern rings. And of course, by page 23, I went, bingo. That's exactly what happened. They're not going to give up their rings. Page 24, there's the second interlude. It's about the ring returning to Oa, but it doesn't have anything to return to. At least I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Or is this the ghost? It's kind of a confusing interlude.
With the Green Lantern of Trant?
Yes. But the ring glows no more, so I have to wonder, is this ring now dead for good because it went back to the power battery and there wasn't any power? Or will there be a return to it? It's really not ever talked about again. I mean, it would have been a nice little something at the end, but then at the end we have to deal with the death of Arcus Chemuk, and we even get a panel about Jon Stewart. It just would have been nice if they had given us some sort of an ending to that story. Instead, we just had this part of the interlude, and I don't remember it ever being revisited again after this.
Yeah, it is kind of a confusing page.
Yeah.
It's a gas planet, right? If we're talking about page 24, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, it's a gas planet. Yeah, we never get a resolution, but it was...
Well, it goes back to Oa.
The ring does? No, the ring goes to the center of the gas planet because it suddenly has weight. There's nothing there to hold it up except for its own power, and as soon as that power is done, the power battery itself...
Oh, now I understand. Okay.
That falls into the middle of the planet, to the core.
Gotcha. So I guess that ring is gone.
Apparently.
Yeah, because it's never talked about again, at least not in this issue, and I can't imagine they would revisit that for a later issue. Page 26, back to talking about other dimensions, and exact same thing I said before. I don't get why it can't just be different parts of space, or if they are going to go into other dimensions, why not send them into other universes? Like, here's the universe from Earth 2, but we don't have to deal with Earth 2 itself because we're in another part of the universe. But maybe that's going too far. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. Page 28, we get the big villain reveal, and man, does that costume look silly. I just don't find the look of this guy to be something that's intimidating. I just would look at him and laugh before he cut my head off with that sword. Page 31, I love lines like this, where the villain says, "Mayhap a taste of my awesome abilities will convince you." It kind of makes me think of Neil Patrick Harris on How I Met Your Mother. When I'm sad, I stop being sad and I'd be awesome instead. Page 32. I think I have some of those DC Comics Presents that are mentioned here. In fact, the whole time, this villain, how the eyes would show up the way that they would, it made me think of the villain that's on the cover of Superman Special Number 1 from 1983. And I'm not sure if that's related at all.
I don't think so.
Okay.
This guy, he appeared in issues 56, 65, and 72 of DC Comics Presents. Those were all written by Kupperberg.
Okay.
The one on the cover you're thinking of was he has an open cranium, a glass cranium. Yeah. You can see his brain.
Yes. But the
brains.
Eyes.
Brains. Brains.
What were the issue numbers again?
56, 65, 72.
I only have 56. Okay. Gotcha. I've got others that are right around then, but they're not quite the right ones. But anyway. Page 34. Hey, that's not cool, Arcus. It was Chip's idea to have the other lanterns funnel their power into one lantern. And just because you're bigger doesn't mean that you're the best option. It's not fair to Chip. Like, no, you're too small. He's still a Green Lantern. Just saying. But then Chip would have died. Well.
And everybody loves Chip. The question I had on that is if... Sorry to interrupt your notes, but if their rings weren't responding to commands, then how were they able to channel the power into Arcus?
Because.
Okay.
That's how it works, Michael.
Okay.
That's how it works because it's how they say that it works. It's a deus ex machina. There is, on page 37, more of this philosophy of the power of hope. And the thing is that for a Green Lantern, that literally does have power. So, yes, it's kind of one of those philosophical things that the power of hope does have some serious weight. And in some cases, that is sort of true, but it's literally that way for a Green Lantern. And that's why I especially like it here as opposed to in a Superman comic. On page 38, does anybody else feel like the artist suddenly hit his deadline and had to rush the last few pages?
Yeah.
Just a little bit?
Yeah, I didn't make a note of that in my notes, but yeah, it did kind of get sloppy right at the very end.
Which is too bad, because I did overall enjoy this story, and it wasn't one of the best ones, but it wasn't bad, and it had some cool kind of fun moments. I especially liked the thing with the fake constructed rings that Kat Batui was doing with Zax's, who she was with. And at the end, so Arcus Chumik is dead, and I'm pretty sure that he comes back because I can swear I remembered seeing him in later comics. But I don't know what the story is that it's going to happen, so nobody tell me. When we get to it, it'll be a nice surprise.
I didn't go page by page for this. It took me a long time to get into it. I think it's just the layout really was hard to follow in some parts. And I thought the art did progressively get sloppier and sloppier, as I was talking about before we started recording.
It's one of the curses of the annual format, because I think a lot of these artists are used to doing a 24 or 22-page story, or in some cases even... 16, 17-page story with a backup, and here you have 40 pages, and I think those deadlines can sneak up on you pretty quick.
Yeah, it's got to hurt.
Yeah, and that's totally an assumption on my part, but that's what appears to happen to me.
Yeah, I can see that. I'll support that assumption. I did like on page 2 and 3 that we do kind of get the roll call without it being... I didn't feel like it was awkward. But this was kind of the era that I talked about when we first started doing the show, where I would pick up maybe an issue like this one and, you know, who are these people? So, I mean, this was – and maybe I was predisposed to that, so I'll put that on the table. But overall, once I finally did get going in the issue, which was around page 6, when they, you know, start flying off and actually, you know, really the story kicks in, I really started getting into it. And I kind of agree with Jeffrey. Why are we hopping universes? Space is pretty big.
To speak really quickly about what you were just saying, how it can be hard to tell different lanterns apart unless you get some sort of a roll call, that's actually one of the reasons why I was so interested in doing this podcast, because then I might get a better idea of who some of these characters are that I just can sometimes have a hard time keeping straight. I didn't know who Zax was before this.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, here in the last few years, I mean, there are certain characters that will be put up front. Kilowog, for example. But then there are a lot of background characters who are, you know, even historically now, a lot of these characters aren't necessarily around anymore for one reason or another. But every now and then you'll see them just standing in the background, and who is this person? What is
this? Well, now there are so many colors that you have to keep different alien faces and alien bodies with alien names straight that are specific parts of the color spectrum. And in some ways that's harder. In some ways it's easier because I think that Geoff Johns did a really great job in how he introduced them.
No, true.
That it wasn't just suddenly here are all these characters, learn their names.
No, we eased into it.
Right. And so I figured that this podcast would be a good way to kind of ease into who some of these characters are.
That and read some good Green Lantern stories.
That was the secondary option.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned colors because that brings me into page 13 where my few page-by-page notes. Page 13, really on page 14 is where it kicks in high gear. But once we enter into this pink-red spectrum, I'm kind of glued to the page, and I don't know why. The color just – it kind of contrasts for me so much that I cannot take my eyes off the page. I don't mean that as a compliment or as a detraction, just a statement of – well, really, it's on page 14. That's the really
– that's just area. A well-done page.
Yeah.
Art-wise.
Well, look at the cut across – maybe that's the natural flow of it is you have this panel that literally runs from the top – left corner to the almost to the bottom right corner. And yeah, it's just gorgeous. And then, you know, Gil Kane is kind of choppy in this issue, but that page stands out for me.
Yes, and the part of the nature of a Green Lantern comic book is that it is going to be in some ways monochromatic. And if there are going to be a lot of colors, there will oftentimes be one specific color other than green. And that's not so much true in some of the more modern ones, but out of this era and even earlier than this, that's very much the case. Because if it was always green, that would get kind of boring. Mm-hmm. So you get green, and then, of course, you get yellow, which is the weakness. But it is nice to have a really vivid other color as part of the story as well.
Yeah. And I had the same kind of note in the bar that, hey, I was glad to see an alien planet, just because I like the sort of otherworldly aspects when you can tie it back correctly. I don't like to see Hal or John out there as much, but when you have some of the other members of the Corps going to, you know, the cantina, and I'm always fascinated by just some of the backgrounds. And then you have the nice, you know, subterfuge of the rings.
I still like it when Hal or John or any of the other Earth ones go into a space cantina, especially when Lobo's there.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I'm not a huge fan of Lobo, I mean, that's sort of where he lives.
It's kind of what he does.
Yeah. And the best there is at what I do, and what I do is drink.
And get cirrhosis. Yeah, the villain of the story, his costume looks like a cross between Geo-Force and Eric the Red from the X-Men. It's garish, really.
Not that intimidating.
No. And just really one thing, and then I'm pretty much done, is the Guardian, who's been floating around, looks like a Macy's parade float. through like the whole half of the second half of the issue. That ended up being really distracting for me.
He's a Macy's parade float of Julia Schwartz as a blue midget wearing a robe.
Overall, I mean, in the end, it had its weaknesses. It wasn't stellar, but it was not by any means wretched. It was actually a pretty good standalone Green Lantern story.
What do you guys think of the cover?
You know, I hadn't really even thought that much about the cover. The characters look pretty cool. The villain who's sort of in the center, that's like the big mystery of who the villain's going to be. Just expect to be let down when you find out.
Yeah.
But you see sort of a light version of a silhouette of who the villain is, except this one, unlike the villain in the story itself, is not horny. As in, has horns on his head.
Correct.
Hey.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
I appreciate that they had confidence in either the Green Lantern brand as a whole or in the quality of the story to put a book out there without either Hal or John on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an annual and it costs, what, 2/3 more than a regular book. So, I mean, $1.25 is cheap for a comic today, but back then it was quite a bit more.
But hey, aliens buy comics too.
Right.
Racist.
Yeah, thanks. But like David, I had very few page-by-page notes on this, even though I did enjoy it, and I think you guys hit a lot of it. Pages 2 and 3, I really like the splash here. I didn't think of it as a roll call until David mentioned it, but it does serve that function as well, and it's just a nice layout and a nice moment of the Lanterns saying the oath, and we get a little inset of each one of them saying a line. Page 3, I like the nice vertical panel here of the Lanterns descending down back to the ground. That was another nice piece of art. Skipping ahead to page 12, the way they split off into pairs here reminded me of the old JSA and JLA stories where they would you see the whole team together at the beginning and then they'd split off for separate adventures and then come back together at the end. I don't know if that was an intentional throwback to that or not, but it reminded me of that. Skipping ahead to page 25, this is where the story got a little confusing for me. We've been seeing these eyes, you know, throughout the story, and I thought they were just symbolic of, you know, Maldor watching from another dimension, but here it seems like Chip and Arcus can see the eyes, and then the eyes attack them. So are we to take from that that they could see the eyes all along, or that the dimensional barriers were weakening at this point, allowing Maldor to come forth?
Let me make sure I understand the question. That the eyes are the result of the barriers coming down, so they can see the physical manifestation?
Right. I don't know, because, like, if you go back to earlier in the story, if you go back to page 6, you can see the eyes there, and over on page 12, you can see them. They're there in space, but I didn't take it that the characters themselves could see the eyes. But then here on page 25, Chip and Arcus act like they can see him, and then the eyes attack him. So are we to take it that they could see the eyes all along, or...?
I think it could just be a visual representation that for the audience, the same way that in a lot of Superman TV shows, you get sound effects when there's flight happening, that sort of thing. And okay. I honestly think that's meant for the audience more than, well, especially in Smallville, that those kinds of things are meant for the audience and not things that you would actually see if you were a character in the show.
Okay. But then here on page 25, the characters can actually see them because the dimensional barriers are breaking down.
Yeah, and they actually say it.
Okay.
They actually verbalize it here, so I guess, yeah.
That does make it more confusing that they eventually do see it.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Okay. And I'm not sure here over on page 27 why Maldor allowed the Lanterns to be all warped to one place, which allowed them to rally and come back and beat him. That seemed a little weird. But that was
I didn't think about that. He did allow it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because he didn't have to do that. He could have kept them separate.
Let's be honest, he's clearly not the brightest so far.
No, he did choose that costume himself.
There you go.
But that's all I had as far as page by page that you guys didn't hit. Despite my confusion over some parts, I did really enjoy this, and it was nice to see. Nice to not only get a big kind of cosmic-y outer space story, but to also get a book-length story focusing on the non-Earth-based Green Lanterns. So I'm happy they chose not to include either Hal or John in this, aside from that one little panel cameo at the end. So yeah, I liked it. The Meanwhile column in this issue has a memorial to Don Newton, who died August 19th, 1984. Newton illustrated that Chip backup story that we talked about last episode from Green Lantern 181, and that was one of his final stories that he illustrated.
Am I thinking that the same... Is he did a lot of Superboy work early on, correct?
Don Newton?
possibly. Never mind. No, he's a little bit younger. Never mind. I'm thinking of a different Dawn.
Okay. But that's it for... There's no letters page, obviously, because it's an annual. So if neither David or Jeffrey have any more comments, we're going to take a break and then come back to talk about Green Lantern 184.
Listen to this promo for the BatmanUniverse.net, or I'll break you.
The BatmanUniverse.net, your source for all things related to The Dark Knight, including the latest news related to the comics, movies, TV, merchandise, video games, and much more. Each month, an assortment of podcasts are produced, including a bi-monthly comic podcast, special commentaries and interviews, the Batman Universe specials, and a podcast which delves into TV, movie, merchandise, video game news, and beyond. Keep up to date with everything about Batman, get to know the kooky and lovable casts of the podcasts, listen to in-depth conversations about the latest direct-to-video movies, and increase your knowledge about the Dark Knight and his family, only at thebatmanuniverse.net.
I'm Dustin from the BatmanUniverse.net, and I approve this message.
And coming back to look at our first regular issue of this episode, I have the synopsis for Green Lantern number 184, cover dated January 1985, went on sale October 18th, 1984, one day before my birthday. And this is Earth's
How
other
old
Green... six.
Okay.
Six or seven.
I was five. I was almost six at that point.
Yeah. Time travel.
Yeah.
It's a gasser.
Okay. We have to go back to the future.
Sorry to interrupt, but that is
okay. Yeah. This is Earth's Other Green Lantern, which is actually a reprint tale with some tweaks to it from Green Lantern number 59 in March 1968. Writer was John Broom. It was penciled by Gil Kane, who seems to be popping up a lot in this episode. Inked by Sid Green, edited by Len Wein, with a cover by, well, Gil Kane. It is actually a new cover, so I was kind of psyched to see that. And Hal Jordan greets us at the top of the issue with a short introduction to the story and Guy Gardner, and this was actually in the original, just slightly tweaked here. Originally, he had a blue suit on, and some of the dialogue has changed. Just a little bit, actually. And going into the story on Oa, the Guardians introduce Hal to a machine that stores memories from the brain even after death. Now, as morbid as that is, Hal is all in and seeks out the memories of his predecessor, Abin Sur. And through that, we get a flashback to Abin Sur's death, which we saw in showcase number 23. Oh, crap. Showcase number 22. We saw that in the brain fart issue. And moments before he summoned Hal. And we learn a startling secret that Hal Jordan was not the only candidate to take Abin Sur's power ring. The other was schoolteacher Guy Gardner. Curious about what could have been in the event that Guy had been chosen, Hal is shown the potential alternate future by way of the memory machine. Uh-huh, that's right. And Guy's career pretty much goes pretty much as Hal's did with some same villains until Guy takes a path back to Earth that Hal never took. And it is on this path that Guy comes across bursts of energy in space coming from a nearby planet. When he swoops in to investigate, he finds two robotic-looking adversaries having a bit of a shootout. And when they take shots at Guy, he uses his Green Lantern ring to knock the crud out of them, which actually ends part one. In part two, he uses his ring to probe the minds of the combatants, and Guy learns that this is the planet Gera, which is inhabited by children. Eons ago, the adults were all wiped out by a yellow plague, and the children stopped aging at that time. So now the bored children start playing war games, and thus the robots, who are colored for the two camps, blue and orange. Concerned, Guy goes to rein the kids in, and to Guy's surprise, the kids in the blue camp have mental powers, which they are able to use to bring him under their power. The children think Guy is a robot of some kind, and they send Guy to capture all the members of the orange team. So Guy seeks the orange team out, wrecks their big orange toys, and it turns out, well, they have mental powers too. So Guy gets caught in the middle of a mental tug of war. Guy actually uses the division to break free, forms green armor to deflect any further psychic attacks, and he's able to bring the kids to peace, and Planet Gera is great with that warm, fuzzy moment. Aww. But Guy heads home and finds himself overcome by the yellow plague mentioned much earlier in the issue. Dying, Guy seeks out a replacement and summons Hal Jordan. A guy passes away before he can tell Hal the oath, but Hal somehow manages to recite it word for word. And back at the machine, Hal decides that he should meet Guy Gardner, and shortly thereafter joins Guy's athletic club, where the two become friends. And in the end, Hal reminds us that a run-in with Sinestro has left Guy little more than a vegetable, which is why John Stewart took over for Hal instead of Guy. And with a wink, he says, "You never know when that information will come in handy."
Which is to say soon.
Yeah. Although, well, I'll get to that in my notes. who wants to go first this time around?
I think it's Michael's turn.
I'll go first on this one. I'm going to read this. Let me talk about the cover first. I really like this cover. It's not my favorite that we're going to be covering this episode, but I really do like it, and I think it would make a nice poster, especially if they did some retouching on it so that each lantern had the you know, the unique costume that he wears today.
Oh, yeah. I'd actually kind of like it just as it is.
Oh, yeah?
I would really like this one as a poster. It's not my favorite cover out of this month either, but of the three, it's the one that I would want as a poster.
Do you want me to go ahead and talk, David, about the differences?
Yeah.
And
touch-ups, right?
And stuff? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like David said, this is a touch or a reprint from Green Lantern 59 from 1968, and there are some art touch-ups, and those were done by Dick Giordano according to the Grand Comics database, and they include significant tweaking of Hal's face and clothes on page 1. The text on page 1 has also been rewritten to reflect that Hal is no longer a Green Lantern and that John Stewart's around now. They reworked the splash page on page 12, and then they added the last three panels of the story where Hal basically turns to the reader and says, you know, "You might need to know this story someday, wink."
But I'll say, just it seems pretty seamless, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
So kudos to them for making a pretty seamless experience.
Yeah, it is a stark contrast, though, in Gil Kane's former style than the style he was using at this time when you look at the cover compared to the inside of the story, or even the inside here compared to the inside of the annual. You can just tell a big difference in the style. But I'm going to read the text on this opening splash because I just love it. It's just so Silver Age. We've got Hal standing here with his, you know, hands kind of awkwardly posed, and he's pointing over his shoulder to an image of Guy fighting Sinestro the Shark and Sonar, and he says, "My name is Hal Jordan, but until recently, you knew me better as Green Lantern. Now, take a look at that guy behind me. He's wearing what was once my uniform, fighting my most formidable foes with what was once my power ring. And yet, I must admit, he has just as much right to that uniform as I had. Hey, if you think John Stewart is something, wait till you meet Earth's other Green Lantern." It's just so campy in Silver Age.
It is kind of funny from a podcaster note-taking point of view, as far as now that there is more than one Green Lantern, I can't just say Green Lantern. I have to say which one it is, and I have to mention if he's in costume or out of costume in his secret identity form.
Yeah, it makes doing the synopsis a little more difficult.
Just a little more.
But as for my page by pages, page 2, the Guardians introduce the mental postmortems, and you got to love that highly advanced alien plot device technology.
It's
page 6, panels 3 and 4, after Hal puts on the ring, his eyes are green, where if you look back at page 1, they're blue. I thought that was a nice touch, though it could have just been a miscoloring. But then in panel 5, Hal says, "At one time, I thought I had given myself the name, i.e. Green Lantern, but actually it was planted in my mind by Abin Sur." And while it's true, if you go back to the origin in Showcase 22, that Hal names himself Green Lantern, but if you look one page earlier in this retelling, Abin Sur says Green Lantern twice in reference to his title.
Oh, yeah.
So it's...
I never really noticed that. Interesting.
Hal also says he donned the special uniform that Abin Sur left him. No, he stole Abin Sur's uniform off his corpse, but whatever. You say tomato, I say liar. So.
And that was a very awkward panel when he's stripping the dead guy naked.
Yeah. Jumping ahead to page 10, it's interesting how Guy's imaginary career ended up garnering all the same villains as Hal's, even though he's on the exact opposite side of the country from where Hal would have been. And it strikes me, too, that as much as I hate to say it, that Hal has a really lame rogues gallery.
I was thinking the same thing.
I mean, they've beefed him up in recent years, but at this time, they're all pretty C-list, except for, really, Sinestro.
Yeah, I was going to say Sinestro and, in some ways, Black Hand, but I like how they plug him. Black Hand, the cliche criminal.
That's because at this time, he was a guy that just... He was like a petty crook that just spouted cliches.
Great.
Yeah. You should go back, Jeffrey, and read some of those original Black Hand stories. Very different than how the character was portrayed in Blackest Night.
I really want to. I know that we started with a specific issue. I think that I do need to go back and read all of the Green Lantern comics up to then. I know that I've said that before, but I haven't done it yet.
Page 13. Have you read them, David?
I've read some of them.
I've read some of them.
Yeah. I've been reading a little bit more because I've been reading through the Showcase Presents just to get more background, just kind of see the source. But I haven't gotten very far on them, admittedly.
Page 13. Okay, so eons ago, all of the adults on this planet were killed, leaving only the children who can no longer age. Since then, the kids have divided into two factions and are constantly at war. Given that they never age and probably can't reproduce, shouldn't they have all wiped each other out by now?
Maybe.
I didn't take it as they were actually trying to kill each other, but, I mean, they had, you know, the robots fighting for them. That
I
it really
think
was
trying to
a
kill
game.
Each other.
Okay.
page 17, I really like this splash with, I put Hal on my notes, but it's Guy generating this, if I can find it. Oh, yeah. I really like this splash with Guy generating this huge fist to grab the spaceship. That's pretty great. And page 18, this huge dragon-shaped tank reminds me of Kirby's Mountain of Judgment that he introduced in the Fourth World Stories.
Ooh.
Pages 19 and 20, I don't know how it protected him from the mental control, but I liked Guy's armor. He just needed a giant sword to complete the look. And page 21, Guy has his own oath, which I thought was cool, even though it doesn't really flow. The rhythm of it is all off. But do you guys like the idea that each Lantern has their own version of the oath, or that they all use the same one?
I prefer the version where they all use the same one, but
yeah.
That's me.
Kind of comes back to that regimented feeling that we talked about earlier
right.
on.
But the way this is written, it seems to indicate that charging the ring activated the plague, but I prefer to think it was just a timing coincidence.
I think it was just a timing coincidence, too.
Okay. Yeah.
But speaking back really quick to speaking your own oath, I mean, if I were Green Lantern and I had to come up with my own oath, I would go stick my ring in the Green Lantern and my oath would be Sorry to make you bleep it out.
Page 22, Hal Jordan, insurance salesman, doesn't exactly have the same air of excitement as Hal Jordan, test pilot.
No.
I've not read the 60s stories where he becomes an insurance salesman, so I don't know the story behind it, but it seems like a rather dull change.
Insurance salesmen can be adventurous, too. No, I'm kidding. They can't.
I'm not at all interested in tracking down the issues where that happens, but I would love to know the behind-the-scenes story of why the change was made.
All I'm going to say on that is he does end up homeless at one point after that, so apparently he was not good at selling insurance.
Also on this page, you can tell it's the 60s because Hal and Guy are both wearing suits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I had. I liked this. For a Silver Age story, it had some logic and inconsistencies, but most Silver Age stories do. So the last third or so was pretty exciting, and it had lots of ring-slinging, so I enjoyed that. It's interesting that this entire thing is basically set up as an imaginary story. Hal and Guy meet at the end, but there's really no mention of him being Hal's alternate or successor in the same way that it was described in Green Lantern number 87 when they introduced John. I did a little looking, and following the story, Guy first appeared again in 87, which we talked about in episode 1, and then he appeared in issues 116 and 117, and then in a several issue arc around issue 120 that ended up leaving him as a vegetable, like it mentioned there at the end. But they'll recap those, I think, down the road a few issues when Guy comes back into the books.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert.
And unfortunately, in the 60s, they didn't have the foresight to give him a bowl cut.
No. But it's also interesting how differently Guy is portrayed in this story compared to, what I'm used to today. Because here, he's got really no personality whatsoever.
Well, that was one of my notes is... And of course, I mean, without being too spoilerish, that'll change very soon.
Right.
But his personality for a long time was very bland when he would pop up. And I've read some of his history in spotty chunks. I'm like, wait, this isn't Guy Gardner. Guy Gardner gets punched out in one punch by Batman for being mouthy.
Yeah, he doesn't have much of a personality here, and he turns into Mr. Personality.
Yes, boy does he.
That's all I had aside from the letters page stuff, which I'll save till the end.
Gotcha. The cover, for me, as much as I like it, the only thing that I don't like about it is that it has almost nothing to do with the interior. John Stewart does not appear in the book at all. He's mentioned because he's the new Green Lantern, and that's sort of the new branding that they're going with. Hal Jordan is not Green Lantern at all in the issue. Well, I mean, in the flashback portion of it, I suppose he is still a Green Lantern and on Oa and whatnot, but since the whole thing is a reprint anyway, they can do just about anything they want to with the cover. It just kind of bugs me that it has nothing to do with what actually happens, other than the fact that it's a reprint of Guy Gardner's first appearance. Essentially a reprint, despite what's changed. I love Gil Kane's art. As I go through, I just think to myself, man, I really want to go back to these older ones, because I love Gil Kane's Green Lantern art. Of all the stuff I've seen Gil Kane do, Green Lantern is one of my favorites. By the time we get to page 3, this isn't exactly how it played out in the original Green Lantern origin, because the whole deal with Abensur saying, oh wait, but there are two, that did not happen in Showcase 22. But that's fine as well. Again, we're dealing with more of an imaginary story, and it's kind of interesting that Guy does eventually come back into it. By page 6, up to this point, I gotta be honest, I wasn't really reading the comic. I was more skimming to see if there were any more differences, but there really weren't that much. Page 8, it's got to be hard to hold down any job where you can be called away as a Green Lantern on a moment's notice. But as someone who used to be a teacher, which I used to be a teacher, that's got to be one of the hardest ones. You're in the middle of teaching 6th period, and you have to go save the universe. You're going to get fired from your job.
Uh-huh.
Just want to say. Almost any job, it would be difficult to do that, unless you're maybe a freelance writer and not on an imminent deadline.
Yeah, there's not too many jobs where you're actually working for someone, at a place of business where you can just leave at the drop of a hat like that.
Yeah, it was one of those things when I used to work at the comic book store. It did occur to me when I would think, well, what if I were a superhero? Because I worked in a comic book store. But I'm the only one here. Do I have to – I guess I have to close up. And what will my boss say? Well, anyway, page 10, the villains page. where we see Sonar, the Sultan of Supersonic Sound, the Shark, Preyer on Human Beings, Black Hand, the Cliché Criminal, Dr. Polaris, Master of Magnetism, last but not least, Sinestro, the Renegade Green Lantern. The only villain that I'm not really familiar with is Sonar.
That'll change.
Yeah, I know we're going to be seeing him in a very soon upcoming episode. But we also have the Shark, who looks very different from what we just saw.
He was very... Yeah, and he did not look like he had a shark head in the first appearances.
He looks like a Ferengi with Down syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dr. Polaris looks like he's wearing pajamas.
He really does. And I'm familiar with Dr. Polaris, but he just looks so silly in this outfit.
He looks like he's in pajamas doing magic tricks.
I mean, he doesn't look any sillier than Juggernaut did in his first appearance.
I have never seen that.
Okay, well, take a look. Am I thinking... Yeah, I am thinking of Juggernaut. Okay, well, anyway, though. Moving on, it's kind of funny how these kids that Guy Gardner goes to visit on this planet, they are described as being humans. All of the humans died, the adult humans died, but the human children, so on and so forth. But they're described as being humans, even though they are aliens, very much so. And they look like humans as well. But, so on page 15, so on this planet, the kids never grow older, so it's like Neverland. But they decide, you know what, let's just kill each other, as children do. I really got a kick out of the fact that they got around to choosing gang colors, because this is the Crips versus the Bloods right here, except it's blue and orange. And of course, you know, we could take the blue versus orange even farther to say that it's hope versus avarice, but it's a little early for that. But at least neither side chose green, or else Guy would have had to have chosen a side. Like, okay, you guys are green. Yeah, I'll fight for you guys, and I'll kill kids. That'll be fun. Moving on to page 20. Okay, so the kids are really easy to convince, and Guy basically just says, hey, don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah.
So they stop. I need to try that with my cat. Oddly enough, that was actually a note. I need to try that with my cat. That's really funny to me right now. Page 21, interesting ending with Guy getting the yellow plague. I did wonder about that as soon as it was mentioned and then Guy went to the planet. I thought, is he going to get the yellow plague and die? It is an imaginary story, so that could happen. And of course it did. And on the final page, page 23, I have a WTF moment. That's not why Hal quit the Corps. It's explained here on page 23 that Hal, he said, you know, I need to keep my word. Guy actually filled in for me for a time or two as Green Lantern until a run-in with my old foe Sinestro left him as more than a vegetable, which is why when I decided to resign from the Green Lantern Corps, the Guardians gave my power ring to John Stewart instead. Just thought you'd need to know. That's not how it happened.
He's not saying... Oh, okay, never mind. I thought you... No, that's not... He's not saying that's why I resign. It's saying, well, this is why when I did resign, it went to John Stewart instead of Guy.
I just read it wrong the first time and took a note on it. Go ahead and delete that.
Those four-letter words are important.
Which is why, comma, there is a comma. There is a comma there. Okay. Very well.
As you were.
As you were. Okay. David?
You guys covered a lot of my notes. There was a part of me that on page 3 when we're looking at Abensur again, I literally said, really, haven't we just covered this again and again on this show? We get it. Abensur dies when he comes to Earth. But luckily, it took a different turn. I was thankful for that. I thought Guy's personality... I look forward to when he comes back, as Jeffrey calls it, as Mr. Personality. Ultimately, I kind of got knocked out of this story really quickly because this is a weird way to reintroduce Guy. I mean, obviously, maybe too obviously, guy's coming back into the story soon. But when he does, there's actually, within the context of the issue itself, there's actually adequate explanation of his origin and where he's been. It's pretty self-contained, so this was pretty superfluous. And we're talking about a book coming out in the middle of a renaissance on the Green Lantern book. And some of the best stories Green Lantern has seen for a while. And out of nowhere, bam, we're going to throw a random Silver Age flashback in there. And this, there's so much going on that in real time, I would think readers would have a hard time getting back into the book once we get past the issue.
I think it's possible that this reprint was a pretty last-minute fill-in, because there are some comments in the letters pages for the next couple issues that I was going to bring up that lead me to believe that it was.
Okay. Well, what are some of those? Because that was...
You want me to do them now or when we get to those issues?
Let's do them when we get to those issues.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry.
But the thing about that is that I really like being able to go back and take a look at some of these stories. And in 1985, or actually it was released at the end of 1984, going back to look at those issues would actually be a very expensive prospect.
Mm-hmm. True. I mean, we didn't have the reprint, or any, really hardly any reprints. Trades were rare. So, I mean, I will give you that it is kind of a nice and historical aspect. And the story itself is really good. I like Gil Kane a lot on this. I like his older style much more than the new style we just saw in the annual.
I was the same way for the longest time with John mm-hmm. Byrne's art.
Ooh, good point. I think the Lord of the Flies, Neverland, planet is pretty cool. But I didn't get the idea that they were literally trying to kill each other. They built big toys that would kill other toys. But the children themselves were not – I would say they might be in danger, but ultimately they weren't piloted crafts.
I think they're trying to kill each other.
What do you think, Michael?
I took it that they were actually trying to kill each other.
Okay. See, I just took it that, and maybe they are.
It might have started out as just, you know, quote unquote harmless fun, but I think it escalated after that, and they were actually trying to kill each other.
If you were alive for 1,000 years and still hadn't hit puberty, wouldn't you try to kill something?
Okay, fair enough. No, it honestly seems like, I mean, they have a bunch of robots, you know, fighting each other, and it's kind of a bragging rights thing, but I may be reading that wrong. I may be hoping this really didn't go Lord of the Flies and Guy Gardner has the conch.
I just figure that if they weren't trying to kill each other, but they wanted to do this kind of thing, they would play Risk.
Well, this would be like a big budget version of Risk.
Okay.
I don't know. We'll let the readers or the listeners, you know, if they have something to add, they can throw it in, but maybe I'm overthinking it. I may be guilty of that too. I'll go on record.
Well, I've never been guilty of overthinking anything.
The bigger question, which I just realized, is if this yellow fever was what was retarding their aging, then how was Guy's ring, which is useless against yellow, able to burn it out of them?
It wasn't.
At the end of the story, he says, "I used my power beam to make all the children of Gera normal again. They will grow up to become adults and have children, blah, blah, blah."
Oh, I actually didn't catch that part. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Goes to show I was reading it too quickly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, there goes the now the rest of the questions are null and void.
Maybe it's not – maybe the viruses themselves are not actually yellow. They just make you look jaundiced. And
oh, okay.
So they called it the yellow.
That makes sense. I'll go with that just to keep my
But I've never been guilty of overthinking anything.
That's all the notes I had that you guys didn't cover.
If it's not actually yellow, then his ring should have protected him from it when he got back from Earth to Earth.
Maybe it's not yellow, it's canary. And they call it yellow.
I'm not Superman, I'm Superboy. Yeah, okay.
I'm Superboy, I'm just 22 years old.
Right. So you got anything else, David?
Now that
we've totally derailed your notes.
No, you pretty much hit all the points that I had other than what I just said, so.
All right. Well, in the letters page, they've printed 4 letters reacting to Green Lantern number 180, which was the final issue from episode 4. That was the issue where Hal decided he was quitting the Corps. The letters have a mostly negative reaction towards it. One writer is upset with Hal. Another is upset with the writers, saying it's all forced drama for the sake of change. And one writer has a very vitriolic rant against Carol Ferris, which...
I really like that rant.
Isn't wrong. Yeah.
Well, Carol Ferris wins the Selfish Shrew of the Year award for performance. Does her relationship with Hal entitle her to his 24-hour-a-day presence and personal services?
Well, I like the one above it, too.
That's how I felt about it. I went on maybe a little bit less of a rant.
I like the one above it, too, where he actually tied it into Steve Trevor and Lois Lane about being annoying and selfish.
Which they are.
He says, yeah. How in anybody's right mind can Hal be in love with a selfish woman such as Carol Ferris? I'm referring to issue 180. She accused Green Lantern of being the Guardian's lackey, but instead she wants Hal to be her lackey. After spending a year in exile in space, I thought Hal had made up his mind about his responsibilities. Life isn't easy. Jordan wants to have his cake and eat it too, as the saying goes. But as Superman told Hal, those with powers are a breed apart and must sacrifice their own personal liberties in the protection of the weak. Look at the Atom and Jean Loring. It took 20 years for them to realize that they weren't right for each other. Don't make the same mistake with Green Lantern. Get rid of that selfish, low-life of a creature that claims to love Hal. He needs a woman who understands his responsibilities, not a selfish witch who wants to call it quits when going gets tough. It seems the non-powered men and women of Earth 2 are made of sterner stuff than those of Earth 1. The spouses of the Earth 2 Superman, Flash, and Wonder Woman, among others, are a lot more willing to make sacrifices for the ones they love than those of Earth 1. All Earth 1 has to offer are companions. All Earth 1 has to offer as companions are selfish people such as Lois Lane, Jean Loring, and Steve Trevor. Now you can add Carol Ferris to that list. I say to hell with them all. They are more worthy companions for the superheroes than what they've settled for.
And as far as Adam and Jean Loring, I mean, well, they do get back together, and there's never any more jealousy in there.
Ooh.
No. It's a love story for the ages.
Yeah, that's a whole different crisis than the one we're about to deal with.
Yep.
While we're talking Guy Gardner, I also want to bring your attention to a new podcast that started up. It's called Just One of the Guys, and it's hosted by Sean Engel, and he's going to be looking at Guy Gardner stories from the 1990s series and moving forward. He's given us a plug in several episodes, so I wanted to make sure and give him a shout since we're talking about Guy. Yep. You'll probably hear a promo later in this episode, but you can find his show at justoneoftheguys.libsyn.com, and it's also on iTunes, I believe.
It is, yeah. It's he's trying to bring more guy love to the internet.
Wait a second.
Not that kind of guy love.
No, the Green Lantern Corps has a don't ask, don't tell policy.
Still? Anyway, are we wrapped up on 184?
I think so.
Okay.
And Guy Gardner is a douche.
Especially Guy Gardner, who was being a bit of a douchebag, but he wasn't really listening.
That's Guy's
like that.
Thing.
Yeah, but...
That's his other superpower.
Speaking of Guy Gardner, page 19, I resent the brain damage comment.
He was just a character I found extremely grating.
Wow, the internet seems to be filled with people who really can't stand the character of Guy Gardner. I mean, to some extent they have a point. I mean, they'd read the character like I have, his adventures with the Corps, his solo comic run, whatever. Maybe they'd have a little more appreciation for him. I mean, there needs to be more guy love on the internet. Maybe not that kind of guy love. Regardless, there still has to be a way that a middle-aged man like myself with a love of comic books should be able to present a defense for an underrated character.
If you build it, they will come.
What was that?
If you build it, they will come.
Okay, strange disembodied voice. That's a great idea, but I really don't see how building a baseball field in the middle of a cornfield will help with matters. I mean, I think there aren't any cornfields near here, especially once they're the owner let me build a baseball field in. Plus, Guy was more of a football player and...
No. Look, no speaking metaphor. What I meant by build was, oh, maybe make a podcast about it.
Well, that's an even better idea. And it's a lot easier, given my farming and athletic abilities. I could recount all the appearances in Guy in comics. I could focus on his solo run. I could give detailed plans of his bar and...
Hold on, champ. You really want people to actually listen to the podcast, don't you?
Well, yeah.
So why not start with the 1990s Green Lantern and continue on to the Reaper?
Well, that's an even better idea. I could cover the Guy Gardner solo series along the way, and also put up for a defense my second favorite GL, Kyle Rayner. Plus, really, these are the two Earth-based Green Lanterns. For whatever reason, they're really overlooked in the mass media. Plus, I've got a nearly complete runs of both series. Wow! Thanks, strange disembodied voice.
No problem. Now let's go kill President Nixon.
You do know that Nixon has been dead for well over a decade.
Well, how about some brownies?
Mmm, that sounds great. I love some good brownies, especially the one with the chocolate frosting on top. Or have you ever had Blondies? Those are even better. I had one of those at church. Just One of the Guys, a Green Lantern podcast, is a weekly internet radio show covering the Green Lantern comics, starting with Green Lantern number 1 in 1990, and ending with Green Lantern number 181 in 2004. During the run, I will be placing special emphasis on the characters of Guy Gardner and Kyle Rayner, my two favorite and the most underappreciated members of the Green Lantern Corps. Along the way, I'll be covering the Guy Gardner comic run, some Green Lantern annuals, and whatever else takes my interest at the time. Come listen along with me, Sean Ingold, as I make the case for the Green Lanterns who deserve a better reputation at justoneoftheguys.libsyn.com.
All right, so we are back with Green Lantern number 185, which was cover dated February 1985 and released somewhere around November 15th of 1984 for a price of 75 cents. Our totally awesome cover is by Dave Gibbons, and our title of the story is In Blackest Day, and it's never been reprinted, but as I mentioned at the top of the show, it will be in that Green Lantern Sector 2814 trade that's coming out in December or November. I think November.
So this came out right after I turned 5 years old.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Our credits are Len Wein, writer-editor, Dave Gibbons, illustrator, John Costanza, letterer, and Anthony Tollin, colorist. We open on the evening of the same day as in issue 183. On a ring-created patio outside a restaurant, Green Lantern and Tony Young are enjoying a candlelit dinner. Well, Green Lantern is enjoying it. Tawny, on the other hand, is all business and wants Green Lantern to tell her more about himself and how he became a Green Lantern. We're then treated to a flashback showing how John was summoned to Oa from his apartment and told by the Guardians that the previous ring bearer of Sector 2814 has resigned and they want him to become the new Green Lantern. John is taken aback by the idea and declines, but is confronted by Cat Matui, Arcus Chumuk, Tomari, Zax, and Aresia, who are apparently the only Green Lanterns that ever hang out on Oa. The Lanterns call John a coward and get bullish, but John stands firm. Katma chimes in with, "This one is just like all the others of his race. Selfish, self-serving," and is cut off by John, who tells her, "I've spent a lifetime listening to garbage like that, and frankly, I'm sick of it. All black men do not have rhythm, and all earth men aren't cowards." And with that, Katma looks him dead in the eye and tells him to prove it. Realizing he needs to put his money where his mouth is, John turns to the Guardians and accepts the offer. After being given a lantern, a ring, and a refresher course on the rules, John is then transported away. And we come back to the present. Green Lantern can only offer a sly no comment in response to Tawny's question about how he became a Green Lantern. Infuriated, Tawny dumps a plate of food on his head and storms off. Meanwhile, at Ferris Air, Bruce Gordon and Tom Kalmaku are doing final checks on the solar jet. After Tom throws another hissy fit about Hal, Bruce gets another threatening phone call from the strange, trench-coated figure from earlier issues, and we learn that the caller is Eclipso.
Yay!
Out on the runway, Hal and Carol share a moment, while being watched from afar by the Predator, who leaps off determined to find who is threatening the solar jet. The next morning at the hospital, April and Jake are with Clay as he's being released. Clay puts on a brave face for them, but underneath still harbors negativity towards his future. Soon after, back at Ferris Air, Carl Ferris addresses those who have gathered for the launch of the solar jet. Richard Davis sucks on some sour grapes and heads down to the locker room to chat with Hal, who is suiting up for the flight. The two chat, and Hal tells Richard how he owes his whole career as a pilot to Richard, and then unknowingly rubs a big old bag of salt in Richard's wounds. A bit later, a fearless test pilot emerges, takes his place in the cockpit of the solar jet, and launches into the sky. As the tests are about to begin, who should come stumbling from the locker room but Hal Jordan? It seems Richard had knocked him out and taken his place on the solar jet in order to get one last ride into the danger zone. Realizing they have no other option, Bruce tells Richard to go ahead with the tests, and 30 minutes later, folks on the ground celebrate the jet's success. Richard is about to bring the jet in for a landing when what looks like a miniature moon eclipses part of the sun, and a shaft of black light appears in front of the jet.
That's no moon.
Unable to avoid it, the jet flies directly into the black light and disappears. As Bruce tries to regain contact with Richard and the jet, we cut to someplace else, where the jet has landed safely in what looks to be a large hangar, and Richard is confronted by his host, Eclipso. To be continued.
Dun-dun-dun.
I'll go first this time, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, knock stuff out.
Got a little bit more on this issue than others.
I think that was actually the expectation, so I'm glad that you all volunteered.
Oh, okay. on page one, is that Jake Ramirez serving them at the restaurant?
I don't think so. It just looks like him.
It looks a lot like him. I actually did a double take. In all seriousness, in page two, John goes from being really over the top with his ring play. Because he has not only the deck itself, but he has the bird bring the waiter in into the building. Then he goes from there to like very subtle, like cutting the pasta with scissors. And as I mentioned, the deck itself, though, John, as an architect, would know to put, you know, a banister around it, right?
Right.
But ultimately, I mean, the reason I bring up the high and low is that he seems to be more proficient than Hal is with the ring. Not to say Hal's, you know, a slouch, but comparing a mechanism like scissors, and I know it's not the greatest mechanism in the world, but it is a mechanism compared to a giant baseball glove. They're kind of apples and oranges.
Yeah, I can see the difference. Mm-hmm. I can see what you're saying.
Well, I mean, down the road...
It's not as big a difference as we would eventually get after Rebirth.
No.
But yeah, there are definitely some differences there, and it's interesting that you point those out. I actually hadn't really paid that close attention to them.
Well, I'm glad that they're writing him a little bit more broad than they could have. They could have just made him Hal with a different colored skin, but no, we're going to actually have a slowly emerging, fully fleshed out character. And I mean, we covered the first installment. I like the John we see here. I mean, he's still got... I wouldn't say he's got a chip on his shoulder, but he's aware of some of the pitfalls, the way the world looks at other races, and he's actually trying to go above and beyond to make sure everybody knows that he's a man in himself, and his skin color is just a part of that.
You know, one of the things that I really like about the earlier era of comics is that it really was a trial and error sort of idea. They would try out certain ideas, and if it did well, it would be revisited. And by the time that you get to now, the present, in we're recording this in 2012, it's very much more here's how it's planned out. Mm-hmm. And this is the way that it's going to go. Whereas here, things have been tried with Jon Stewart, and they're continuing to explore what his differences are going to be. And that comes out in the writing, and it comes out probably in the sales of the comic as well. Because if a comic sells well, then they will go ahead and revisit that. And I just find that to be very different, with the exception of if a comic doesn't sell well these days, it gets canceled.
Rather than, what can we do to change this downward trend.
Right. In the same way that there are some villains that are going to be more popular than others, I don't think the expectation when they introduced Sinestro was that this is going to be Hal Jordan's nemesis, just that this is going to be the villain for this issue. And, oh, look, it went really well. Let's bring him back. And over time, he became the nemesis. And what we're doing right now is exploring who John Stewart is going to be as Green Lantern, instead of introducing him and saying, this is how he is, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
But that's just the way I feel about the modern comic book industry.
It's different. I mean, no, we're looking at, we're looking at a different time.
Okay.
A smaller note on page 3, panel 3, I like John's reaction to when the green glow shows up. You just, uh-oh. Not what I would say, but okay, John. Page 5, when the core members come in with, Kat Matui, Tamar Reed, I'm getting tired of the sort of looking down upon, talking down to their declarations on how people should live their life, on how, you're offered this, you should take it. It's an honor. Well, it's not necessarily an honor to everybody. I don't particularly want to be a police officer, but I respect police officers. And I don't think John was being disrespectful, just this was not his calling, or at least he didn't feel it was his calling. And they're in here browbeating him. That really annoyed me, especially Kat Matui.
I'm with you on that, and I'll get into that a little bit in my notes as well.
Yeah, they're like ringslinging Dr. Phils.
I wouldn't go that far.
But, I mean, Kat Matui, going on page 6, she really almost came off as a racist. I mean, I read it at first. I'm like, oh, whoa. And upon a momentary thought, she sees it as a planetary species. It's not necessarily a skin color or a race.
Yeah, I didn't take it as a skin color thing at all.
No, the first gut reaction was, hey, oh, okay, oh yeah, I'm thinking of it from a terrestrial level,
right.
But
this right. character is... And she's looking at all humans as being essentially the same, whereas he is saying that he's used to that because all white people that he... Well, not all white people, but that many of the white people that he's interacted with throughout his lifetime have looked at him as being a black person and thinking that all black people... are the same way. So there is a sort of a parallel there, which is kind of interesting to me because I look at Kat Matui and all pink people look the same to me.
On page 7, I'm glad Tawny throwing the pasta on John's head didn't break his concentration, because that would have been a really bad... I mean, I'm glad that he has a stronger willpower, because that could have been some bad juju. And
Tawny falls to her death.
Yeah, like, exactly.
I've done that.
Maybe I should have thought that through. Page 8, Eclipso. Yes, this signals the coming of some awesome villainy, and the nice thing is it doesn't end with him. We actually get a good streak of villainy. And by that I mean the shark doesn't show up. Hi, Scott Gardner. On page 10, the whole Clay Kendall thing, it felt more and more like a soap opera than previous issues even, because he's like, oh, we're going out. We're happy. And inside he's like, yeah, I can do anything.
Yeah.
I can do anything except walk again. It makes me think of those overdramatic 1-800 Contracts commercials. Look with my special eyes. If only I could walk. It was really heavy-handed there. And, he's basically becoming Batman now. My parents are dead, except I can't walk. Page 12.
I lump those two ideas together, but if you want to, that's fine.
I just wanted to make the reference.
Okay.
Sometimes I throw things at the wall, see if they stick. On page 12,
I just had a whole scene about spaghetti, so there you go.
There you go. See that? Full circle. On page 12, I started really getting excited after Eclipso showed up and then Rich showed up, because I knew really we're seeing some of these long-running plot threads come together. So I'm like, oh, goody, that we've been waiting for this. So it really felt like we're starting to head up to a fever pitch, and I got really excited for the next few issues. And then my only real complaint, outside of the Clay Kendall thing, was on page 14. when Hal shows up and somebody goes, if Hal's here, who's flying the solar jet? And suddenly I just picture the Benny Hill theme playing. And just like, you know, the quick musical sing. But overall,
and they're just running through doors.
Mm-hmm.
In a hallway.
Exactly.
And then suddenly Davis comes out and just smacks Hal with the helmet and runs away.
Overall, I mean, as the issue came to an end, it was just like coming to the natural point. So I didn't have page by page beyond that. But wow, this issue really got to moving fast. I got really excited reading this. And, you know, and it kind of felt like that momentum that we had before 184 kind of came right back in. So I'll actually retract my note from earlier. It said, would it be hard to jump back on board? Maybe in real time, but in terms of reading these issues back to back, not at all. It didn't affect it. That's all I have.
What about you, Jeffrey?
I really love this cover.
It's phenomenal.
This is probably my favorite cover out of the three that we're going to be talking about. And I actually really like the next one, too. But again, if I were going to have a poster, I would go with the previous one. But this one is very close second. The title, In Blackest Day, I realize what they're going for. And that this one is called In Blackest Day. In fact, the next one is going to be called In Brightest Night. So they're switching up the idea of In Brightest Day and Blackest Night. But it's just, this one is In Blackest Day. And I think to myself, oh, it's a Jon Stewart story. I get it. Wow. I don't think that was the actual intention, but it is kind of funny.
Yeah, they didn't quite think that one through all the way, I don't think.
That's what I'm assuming. I don't think it was actually intended that way, but I'm going to take it that way because it amuses me. On page one, John did promise Tawny an interview, and this is kind of a good way to do it. Like, hey, I'll do my Green Lantern stuff. We'll go to an Italian restaurant where the waiter all Italians look the same, as you kind of sort of said, didn't actually say in your notes, David, but I'm actually going to jump ahead since you already talked quite a bit about page two. Page three, Snap, Crackle, and Pop is John Stewart's thought balloon. Like, God, I love the Snap, Crackle, and Pop because he's eating Rice Krispies. And Kellogg was a regular sponsor for a long time of a lot of DC properties, a lot of Warner Brothers properties. But I don't think this one's actually meant to be product placement. It's just, he's sitting down to his mundane life of, hey, I love Snap, Crackle, and Pop. And suddenly he's taken away. And I do love that moment where he's still pouring the milk, but he's on Owen now. It's such a beautiful moment. And this is the untold story, or at least untold up to this point, of John getting the ring. And that's really cool because we didn't need it right away. It's just John suddenly shows up and it's all about Hal's reaction. And now we get to see what it was actually like. And when John refuses the offer to be the new Green Lantern, I mean, we've already talked about how the other Green Lanterns reacted to that, but this is actually very classic storytelling because there's the call to adventure followed by the refusal to the call. And it's all part of the hero's journey, which was very well laid out by Joseph Campbell, who studied world religion and world mythology of the entire planet Earth throughout time and history. And that's one of the very, very common things, is that you get the call to adventure, but the first thing that the hero has to do is refuse the call. Same way with George Lucas was a huge fan of Joseph Campbell and really liked to follow his outline of storytelling. So if you look at Star Wars, you have Obi-Wan Kenobi saying, you must learn the ways of the Force if you're going to come with me to Alderaan. And Luke's reaction is, I can't go to Alderaan. I have to stay here, because you need the refusal to the call to adventure for it to be a proper hero story. And the only times when you don't get that is when the hero in question is already enlisted in some sort of military, when they need to follow their orders. That's different. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good okay. Analysis.
I did not catch that Zax was there in this scene until Michael pointed it out. I just found that to be kind of interesting, because these are exactly the heroes, with the exception of Chip, who were in the annual that we just talked about. But they're the only ones who just go and hang out on Oa. Oa's got to have like a really good bar.
I kind of took it that the annual took place right after this scene.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, I totally agree with that. That makes perfect sense.
Because if you look back at the annual, let me pull it up here real quick. There's a footnote somewhere.
Yeah, in the annual they do mention it's right after John got the ring.
Yeah, it looks like they're leaving the ceremony.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. I didn't actually put the two together specifically like that. And there's that great moment, all black men don't have rhythm. I know some black people who don't have rhythm. It's very amusing to me. But then you get that South Park reference where, no, you're black, you can play the guitar. You can play bass.
Yeah.
Page 7. I'm kind of both on John's and Tawny's sides here, because Tawny's upset that she's not getting the interview that she wanted. She wanted to hear all about Green Lantern. And John kind of did promise that. But the thing is, he has to keep that secret identity. But he still accepted the interview. He should give her something to report on. Or he should not have invited her out under those pretenses. Yes, I'll give you an interview, but I'm not going to tell you anything.
I think he was just looking for an excuse to go out on a date with her.
Yeah, and I can understand that too, because Tawny's pretty awesome. Unfortunately, she's not going to be a huge remaining character forever and ever.
No.
No. Page 8. Okay, two things. Number one, Eclipso is being set up for the next issue. That's where it's really all going to come out to a head. And two, is anyone else sick of this solar plane?
Yeah, they've kind of run it into the ground at this point.
I actually made the note before even reading the next issue. They better do something with it soon. And they do, of course. So thank goodness they finally did, because I was getting sick of hearing about it. Page 9. Oh, geez. The Predator is still around? I thought we got rid of him.
No, he's going to be around for quite a while, actually.
Yeah, I understand that. I know that he's in the next issue. I assume that we haven't seen the last of him there either. On page 12, there's this reference to the right stuff, because Davis says that to Hal. Yeah, I think Davis says it to Hal, or does Hal say it to Davis? About having the right stuff to be a test pilot. And of course, that's, you know, the right stuff to be an astronaut.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he just smacked Hal with that helmet, didn't he? He's holding the helmet, and then we cut to later on, and it's a question of how he knocked Hal out. He did it with that helmet, didn't he? It just makes the panel resonate even more.
He says it, or Hal says it on page 14. He slugged me with a cyber helmet and then took my place in the flight suit.
Okay. And jumping to not the final page, but the page before that, page 16. Nice. I love this three-panel shot of the solar plane going into this eclipsed part of the... It's either eclipsed or it's some sort of a laser. I know that it's created by the Black Diamond, but it's basically just blackness, a pillar of blackness that the plane can go into. It's unclear how it got from there to being in the hangar, but I feel like I should just forgive that. But it's nice that they finally did something with the solar jet, and I should have guessed that Eclipso would have something to do with this part of the story. It just makes so much sense. As soon as they introduced the solar jet, I should have thought, oh, Eclipso is going to do something with that.
Yeah.
But there you go. But that's what I have to say on it. Michael.
All right. I love this cover, too. It's I just see nothing wrong with it. I mean, it hits... It's a great first-issue cover, even though this isn't a first issue. But given that we're getting John's origin, it is kind of a... It's not really a jumping-on point, but it is very much an introduction to the character. And I think you could really jump on here with this issue and go forward. Page 3, I like here and how over on page 7 that Gibbons used half of John's face to frame the beginning and end of the flashback. It's just a nice little artistic touch to separate that portion out. Page 4, I got to panel 2 here where John refuses the ring. And I'm like, oh, here we go again. But that was very short-lived, and we moved on. Thankfully, John's not going to be a repeat of Hal. that's really all I had to say about the flashback part. I really liked John's initial reluctance to the ring, and as well as the other Lantern's reactions to it. John's speech on page 6 was spot on for the character. I mean, especially in the day that this was published and given how he was introduced. But it still stands up today. And page 7 has a nice shot of John when he gets the costumes. Altogether, a great sequence. I'm glad I got to do the synopsis on it, since I was the one doing most of the complaining about the lackluster introduction he got in issue 182. The only other really page-by-page comment I have that you guys haven't already hit is on page 13. I want to complain that no one recognized it wasn't Hal, but as a Superman fan, I really can't be throwing stones in that glass house. So, but a great story. I mean, I didn't have a lot of comments that you guys didn't already hit, and the back half was a lot of setup or continuation of the kind of the all plots accounted for thing, but I still really enjoyed the front half, and I'm glad we were told how John got the ring. I still think his introduction could have been a little more dynamic, but this was well done, and like I said, his interaction with the other core members was spot on, so that's okay. And I also note there was no... Well, there was Green Lantern in the book, but there was no ring slinging at all, really. We had that opening scene with John and Tawny, and then the rest of the issue was just all the subplots and supporting cast.
No, you're absolutely right. This was very much the setup or plot exposition issue.
Yes.
Which is kind of too bad that we had a recap issue for the previous one. But there you go.
Yeah. So are we ready to move on to the backup?
Yeah, we're ready to move on.
All right. Well, we've got a 6-page backup story called Burdens, which was reprinted in the Tales of the Green Lantern Corps Volume 2 trade paperback. Credits are Kurt Busiek, writer; Don Heck, pencil and inker; Todd Klein, letterer; Shelley, I believe it's Iber, colorist; and Len Wein, editor. A Green Lantern retires. The end.
Nice. Well said. Anyway, moving on to the next issue.
I actually have a longer synopsis if you would like me to go through it.
I would, if you would, please.
The Green Lantern of the planet Farron is addressing the populace, and he tells how he has served the planet for over 500 years, or 500 cycles, as it were. And when he started it out, the planet was younger and innocent and needed a champion. But as time went on, he became a crucial part of life on Farron. He set up alarm systems to alert him of trouble. He began dictating terms of international behavior following a global war. And soon he just got more bogged down in the politics of life on Farron rather than, you know, becoming their judge and regulator rather than their hero. And now that he's nearing death, however, he says he has to think about the planet's future. And speculation and anxiety run rampant throughout the planet, with everyone very concerned about who will be his successor. He then says he's asked the Guardians not to appoint a successor, and if they do, that Green Lantern will only patrol the other planets in the sector, and that Farron will be off-limits. With that, he announces his retirement and flies off. People almost immediately begin fighting amongst themselves about who will lead the planet, and the whole planet just erupts into chaos. The Green Lantern, meanwhile, flies back home to his wife and laments the turmoil the planet has ahead, and that his memory will be vilified. But he says, "I only hope that left to themselves, they will regain what I took from them and become what they always should have been."
Yay! Actually, I didn't have any page-by-page notes. I just like the concepts and the questions that are brought up about superheroes' effects on their environment. Especially if you have something as all-encompassing as a Green Lantern.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because Kurt Busiek would go on to do these kinds of stories eventually, and I sort of feel like this is the best one.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest. I don't think I fully understood what Busiek was trying to say here.
I think that what Busiek was trying to say is that when you have a Green Lantern who is therefore revered for his power, and he's going to give up his power, that number one, you will have people fighting over what that power will be, but that number two, that he was so important and so big in helping these people, that not only would the people fight about it, that it, what it really comes down to is how much they really needed the symbol, and that the symbol is the most important aspect of it. Because symbolically, he is essentially ascended to godhood in the minds of these people.
So basically, it's kind of like, must there be a Superman, just taken to its extreme.
Exactly.
Okay.
Kind of.
Well, yeah.
Yes, but this is a world where there's only one superhero, and that superhero happens to be a Green Lantern.
Right.
And if that's going to be passed on, who is it going to be passed on to? And is there anybody who's actually deserving?
These are the questions we have.
David, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to go through my notes, actually. So if you're not done, I'd like to let
you finish. Done. I just wanted to put the topic out on the table.
Okay. Yeah. I'm already kind of feeling like this is a story that we've seen. We have seen kind of similar stories, but not done exactly in this way. I really do like on the first page how Don Heck realized what Kurt Busiek would look like in about the year 2025 and made him the main character. That was kind of cool. On page 3, based on this story, I mean, this could almost be a Sinestro story, the way that these people revere him, but the fact that he's learned to not abuse his power. If Sinestro maybe had remained in power longer or not ever really had as much power as he had, this could have been Sinestro. This is what Sinestro should have done.
The difference seems to be here. These people just started giving him more and more power, where with Sinestro, he took the power.
Right, and Sinestro could have been given that power, and that's the thing, but instead he took it.
He could have earned it over time, but he was not content to wait for it.
Exactly, and by the time you get to page 5, that's where he's really different. Well, on pages 3 and 4 as well, because we do get quite a bit of background information. Almost the entire story is background information. But you get to page 6, and I thought to myself, that's the end? We get a beginning and a middle?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what led to some of my confusion, because it just seemed to end with no real point.
I think that the point is there, it's just that the point is made in the middle instead of giving it an ending, and it doesn't have an ending.
Never mind.
It just
I was going to try to defend it, but yeah, it does kind of stop. I thought you were referring to where the meanwhile is. Or the whole, so it goes, I'm like, is that the end of the story?
No, and I mean, he's only got 6 pages to work with, and I understand that, but you can still take 6 pages and give a sort of a 3-act structure. Mm-hmm. And with 6 pages, you can technically end it at the end of Act 2, but this is almost ending in the middle of Act 2. I would like to have seen it have some sort of a conclusion, and it doesn't have that.
No, it really doesn't. I guess, something to be said for the reader making up their own mind and not being spoon-fed, but that's not the case here.
Right. So, Michael, do you have anything more on it?
No, not really. Okay. I thought the art was good, although the aliens kind of reminded me of something you might see in Star Trek.
Absolutely, yeah. They look human, but with, like, that one thing that's different about them, which are these eyebrows that sort of come out to be antennas.
Yeah.
Antennae.
Oh, and the Green Lantern isn't named here, but in the Sinestro Corps secret files that came out in 2008, he's given the name Gion.
Oh.
G-I-O-N.
G-I-O-N, Gion.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he's not actually named here in the story. So we got anything else on this backup? Okay.
I like the concept and the question, but I don't know. I'm kind of with Jeffrey. I don't know that it was actually played out the way it should have been. It's kind of like starting a sentence and just not finishing it.
But Busiek would go on to take this theme and turn it into fully fledged stories. And that's one of the things that I think is cool about it, as like a little icon of history.
It's odd that there's no Astro City podcasts.
That would make a good podcast.
Yeah, I know.
There should be. I would listen.
Somebody,
but I'm not
listening to this. Yeah. Has the times doing Astro City podcast. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would love to listen
to one.
I'm
buddy.
Just not going to make it.
That's right. You who is listening to this, you're the one we're talking to. Do it. I dare you.
moving on to the non-story elements of the book, there must have been a lot of behind-the-scenes issues as far as scheduling and creative teams on the book. I mentioned last episode how there was a letter column response saying that Mark Farmer was going to be on as inker for the foreseeable future. Quite obviously, he's gone now as Gibbons inked this story, or the issue's main story, by himself, and he's on the next issue as well. But a letter column response in this issue says that this issue's book-length story will be Gibbons' swan song. Now, this issue obviously wasn't a book-length story, and it obviously wasn't his swan song either, since he does the art next issue. But it goes on to say that after Gibbons leaves, Chuck Patton is going to do 3 issues, and then Joe Staton and Bruce Patterson are to come on board. But that doesn't happen either. I think I might have figured out what happened, though, and I'll talk about that in the next issue, because there are more comments in that letter column that tie into it. But as for the letters themselves, they have more people tearing into Hal and Carol because of what went down in 180 and 181, but they actually seem to be overall more favorable about it now, because it sounds like they were enjoying the writing and art aspects of the story.
Rocketed as a baby from the exploding planet Krypton, Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Superman of the Bronze Age is a weekly podcast covering the adventures of Superman from 1970 to 1986. Join host Charlie Niemeyer at superbronze1970.libsyn.com.
So finally, for this episode, we'll be taking a look at Green Lantern number 186, titled In Brightest Night, as opposed to In Blackest Day, which the last issue had. And in case anybody doesn't understand, that's a play on the Green Lantern... What's the word I'm looking for?
Oath?
The Oath. Thank you.
Three of our four titles this time were taken were plays on the Oath.
Exactly. So the cover date for this was March 1985, but it was released on December 20th, 1984. The credits for, I think, the last time are Len Wein as the writer and editor, Dave Gibbons, illustrator, John Costanza, letterer, Anthony Tollin, colorist, with thanks to Paul Kupperberg for plotting assist above and beyond the Call of Duty. And Paul Kupperberg will go on to being quite a big part of what Green Lantern is going to be in upcoming episodes. So, the story for this is that Bruce Gordon flips out when he realizes that he's completely lost contact with the Solar Jet. Hal blames himself for being knocked unconscious, causing Davis to pilot the jet, but Carol reassures him that this isn't his fault, it's Davis's fault. Davis is a jerk. Hal notices John Stewart excusing himself from the room, and he knows exactly why. John goes off and charges his ring with the power battery in his locker, and he takes off. In low orbit, really, really low orbit, by the way, Davis and the Solar Jet are now in the Death Star, and Eclipso introduces himself. He says that the Solar Jet will allow him to become the master of the world, although we never find out exactly why or how that would work. Davis tries to fight back, but Eclipso uses his Black Diamond to subdue him and imprison him. Back on the surface, Bruce Gordon blames himself some more for Eclipso's involvement, since it's his evil alter ego. And Hal points out that as Green Lantern... that Green Lantern one time, as in him, saw Eclipso die. And just then, the sunlight in the sky begins to block out. Hal pushes Bruce out of the way, but he's too late, and they're all in darkness. Gordon gets sucked up by the tractor beam as John Stewart, as Green Lantern, flies in. He constructs a flashlight to shine on the dark beam, but it's useless. When he's attacked by black lasers, he's able to block them with a shield. Stewart continues to try to make his way in, but has to protect Hal, Carol, and all the others below at the same time, so he is waylaid. Meanwhile, Predator uses a rocket pack to fly up to this Death Star and sneaks in. In this satellite, Eclipso muses about how Hal is Green Lantern, although he doesn't know that it's Hal, was able to defeat him back in Green Lantern number 139. But we get the rest of the story about how he survived and was able to use his Black Diamond to return to this satellite. Eclipso forces Gordon to extract the Solar Jet's power system, which will allow him to separate from Gordon forever. He refuses, but Eclipso threatens to kill the pilot Davis if he doesn't do as he's told. Davis plays the hero and says to let Eclipso kill him, but Gordon gets to work anyway. But it's a ruse. He tells Davis to shield his eyes and uses the power source to generate a blinding light that knocks Eclipso over. Now free, Davis rushes to the solar jet while Gordon fights Eclipso. Gordon tries to get Eclipso to kill him, knowing that it will also kill Eclipso since they're linked, but he's too smart for that. And Davis makes his way out with the jet. Eclipso is about to close the hangar doors, but Predator throws an axe in the gears to stop him. They fight, and Eclipso ends up getting the upper hand and is about to finish off Predator when John Stewart as Green Lantern – see, I need to say it that way because he is Green Lantern, but if I just say Green Lantern, yeah, you know what I'm saying. When John Stewart comes in and moves them apart, Eclipso notices that this isn't the same Green Lantern that he fought before. Outside, Davis contacts Ferris, explaining that the jet has been damaged and he's going to try to land, and he just makes it. Hal and Carol meet up with him and try to help him out of the plane, but they're too late. Davis has suffered a heart attack, and he's now dead. Like, dead, dead. He's not going to be coming back. Back on the Death Star, John throws Gordon and Predator out of the satellite with a construct parachute so that he can battle Eclipso without them getting in the way. Eclipso fires a laser with his Black Diamond at John Stewart, Green Lantern, but he reflects it. The beam hits the controls and activates a death ray that hits the surface of the Earth and is headed towards the city. At this point, Predator breaks free of the parachute and uses his wings to float back to Earth. John tries to put Eclipso into a cage, but he breaks free through the bars and tackles him. They fall out of the hangar doors and plummet back to Earth. They fight some more, and Eclipso clearly gains the upper hand. But just then, the death ray hits him, and John is able to leap out of the way. He flies back to make a construct of a baseball bat and is able to hit the Death Star out into space, where it finally explodes. Back at Ferris Aircraft, Smith wants to blame Davis for all that happened, but Hal won't have his memory tarnished that way, and even puts his hands on him, which he's not that happy with. Carol tells Bruce Gordon that at least Eclipso is gone for good, but he wonders if that kind of evil can ever truly be destroyed. Carol goes to her office and finds a mysterious letter with a rose next to it. It reads, "Sorry I missed you today. See you again. Until then, of remembrance, love," and there's a picture of a skull. To be continued.
Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun. I'm actually not positive who that letter is from. I don't think it's from Eclipso.
No. I thought it was from the Predator.
I think the Predator.
Oh, that makes sense. I get it now.
Which is kind of awkward.
No, I know. It's
very awkward. Yeah.
Who it was supposed to be from. I was like, who is this from?
I'm kind of looking forward to Jeffrey finding out who the Predator is.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know who it is, and I'll find out when we find out in the issues.
Mm-hmm. Which will be – I'm actually going to enjoy your reaction, I hope.
It's Lois Lane, isn't it? It's not Guy Gardner.
Don't hurt yourself. trust me. Just trust me. It'll be a mind blower, and I hopefully will not see it coming.
Okay. I'm trying not to think about it too much. Well, I am going to think about it a little bit, but I do not know who it's going to end up being, and so nobody ruin it for me.
Who's starting out their notes this time?
I think it's Michael's turn to start.
Yeah. Oh, I went first last time, didn't I? No, I had the synopsis last time. All right. This is another great cover. Of the three Green Lantern monthly issues this episode, it's my least favorite, but only because the other two were so great. But I really like this one, too. I liked it better once I actually saw the actual issue rather than just the cover image online.
Mm-hmm.
Page two, we have a nice, fluid, and unobtrusive recap of the pertinent details that we need to know to catch us up to speed. But on page three, so John is wearing his costume now rather than the ring-generated one? They're very inconsistent about that, aren't they?
I was about to say, yeah, because I didn't notice that, but he does have his shirt in the other arm. I'm like, maybe he just took off his jacket, but no, he's...
Yeah.
Well, where does he put the gloves?
But you're right. No, I kind of took it as he's putting on the costume, like it's constructing itself from his ring. But you're absolutely right. Now that I look at it, he's just taken off his jacket, uh-huh, and he's just got it on.
That's very weird. Because when he got the ring from the Guardians, they gave him... They flashed his costume on him then, so he had a ring-generated costume then. I don't know. It's very weird.
Or he's generating it while taking off his civilian clothes.
That could work.
That's the closest thing I can think of, but it's not explained at all.
Until his ring stops working, and then he just ends up getting undressed.
You know, they do it this way because they know that sometime, like 20 years later, there's going to be people podcasting about it.
Pages 6 and 7, I really like these two pages showing John making all the various constructs to try and negate Eclipso's beam. That was pretty nice. It took me a minute to realize what he was doing at the bottom of page 6. I didn't actually get it till I looked through the issue the second time to do my notes, but they're stoppers, and he's trying to plug the holes. I didn't understand what they were at first, but anyway. And Murder Moon is a very awesome name for a ship.
Or the Death Star.
Or the
Death Star.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pages 8. Hey, you know what would make the Predator's costume even better? A jetpack.
Yes.
But see, Jeffrey, the wings do have a purpose, because he uses them to glide down to the satellite.
Yeah, no, the wings do have a purpose later on as well, when he says, I've had enough of this parachute thing, and I just want to go off on my own way.
Yeah.
But it is Guy Gardner, isn't it?
But is this the first place we learn that the Predator is working for Control? Or did I just completely miss that before?
No, he just kind of came out of nowhere earlier. He did in the previous issues. Yeah. He didn't mention it, so...
Because that seems like a pretty big revelation that he wasn't working on his own, and it really casts Mr. Smith's motives in a different light as well. But moving on to page 11, the Predator confronts Eclipso with a line, "Just call me the Predator, and this time, Bunky, I'm here to prey on you." You can definitely tell it's the 80s.
Yeah.
Okay, I figured out who it is. It's Captain America.
Pages 15 through 17. This was a very well done scene. Richard landing the plane and his death. Really, I think Richard was handled well throughout the entire issue. I mean, this stuff can come off as cliched a lot. We all knew he was, you know, going to come off as the hero and that he was going to die. But it really was written well, and I really enjoyed this sequence here.
Yeah, when they're going to set things up in such a grand way that there's no way for it to go other than him being the hero of the story, if they do it well, it can really hold some weight and matter, and they did it well.
Mm-hmm. Page 18, when Green Lantern throws the Predator and Bruce Gordon out of the Murder Moon, the Predator says, "Lantern, you'll pay for this." And John replies, "Fine, send me a bill." Now that's an awesome comeback. The Predator should take notes. Pages 19 and 20, this was actually pretty brilliant of Eclipso, knocking John out of the ship and then using him to make sure he gets down to the ground safely. I thought that was a pretty... I like smart villains, and that was a pretty brilliant idea. Page 21, Eclipso presumably dies. Aside from a very minor cameo in Crisis number 9 and Swamp Thing 46, this is the last that Eclipso has seen for a couple years, so this is pretty much the fate of the Earth 1 Eclipso. Page 22, I think I would have liked to have seen something a little more dramatic than John just hitting the murder moon away with a baseball bat, but that's not a big issue because Eclipso was the bigger threat. But all, you know, overall, just another great issue. Two strong issues this time, in addition to the annual and the reprint, both of which I liked. Ween and Gibbons kind of started out slow, but they really went out on a high note.
I will agree.
What you got, David?
I apparently don't have anything. That's awkward. No,
you have to have some notes.
Well, I did, but I don't. But so I'm going to wing it. Stay calm. I remember opening up the issue, thinking that, I mean, just reading too fast, that, you know, this is recapping the scene or going over the scene that we left last issue in. I'm like, wait, when did John get there? But no, I need to read a little bit slower and more carefully. But all that to say, that was actually a very good flashback to put it all in one spot rather than having a fill-in issue to explain it. I didn't notice that John was changing clothes. I do like that Rich is actually kind of got a little bit of a fight in him. He kind of went out like a champ in this issue. I got to give him some props. Because he's a normal guy going up against Eclipso, and he actually, I wouldn't say he holds his own, but he's respectable.
He went out like a boss.
Yeah, like a boss, like a champ. I agree that John's constructs weren't as exciting. After, you know, we were talking about last issue where he had a lot of detailed constructs and different ways to look at it, but here it's pretty much standard Hal Jordan stuff. You've got the standard hammer. Yeah, and hits him with a baseball bat. It was okay. I don't have anything against that. I was just kind of looking for more from him, and we do get that down the line. And then we've got the Predator. I'm glad that, you know, apparently 90s Marvel writers were reading these issues. Darkhawk, Shadowhawk. How many other characters can we pull from that? A little bit of Daredevil in there, too. But I suddenly realized while reading this issue, I know really very little about early Eclipso. It's odd that we mentioned Gene Loring earlier in this episode, because I'm like, that's kind of Eclipso, The Darkness Within was the first introduction, but the whole Gene Loring thing was the first time I actually saw it within a proper context where I could actually approach it.
I had a similar experience, actually.
Okay. But ultimately, I mean, overall, the issue, it brought a lot of things together, and I'm kind of glad to be done with the solar jet thing and the whole trench coat thing. We've still got the Predator, but it seems like they're seamlessly moving things in and out. And I'll agree that this was a very good wrap-up to Lynn Ween and Dave Gibbons' run. And I'm looking forward to the run that's coming up, too. And as we said before we got into the actual synopsis, page 23, the note from the Predator, that's gonna be awkward down the line.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Okay.
Yeah. Apparently, I deleted all my notes, so sorry about that.
Okay, page one. Right away, I'm interested to see how Eclipso is existing without Bruce Gordon being part of that. They're kind of linked, but it's not really explained. I'm interested to see where that's going to go, but it doesn't really go that far. It goes somewhat, like if Bruce Gordon were, or if Eclipso were to kill Bruce Gordon, then it would end Eclipso. But that's all that we really get. And a quick reminder, actually, about Bruce Gordon's name. The name Bruce Gordon actually came from both Bruce Wayne and Jim Gordon. I'm not sure if anybody was really aware of that. We did a whole thing on From Crisis to Crisis about the Eclipso annuals. And so that's where I learned that from, but it's not something that's mentioned here, and I don't know that it's ever really mentioned anywhere in the comics. So I wanted to throw that out there. Page 2. So Davis was flying the solar jet. He saw a narrow column of darkness that would normally be easy to avoid, and he said, "Well, darn, it's right in my way. I'm not moving for that. Screw you, darkness."
He couldn't. It was too late. He couldn't avoid it.
But it's so narrow. I mean, he's in a jet that's clearly got some level of ability to move. It's okay. Pretty narrow. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
But I suppose that's more for the visual. On page 2, on the last panel, Hal is still kind of annoyed that even though he's the one who gave up the ring, that... I mean, dude, just get over it. It's like, and it isn't difficult for me to guess why, and he makes a fist. Oh, come on. Get over it. Page 4, I have the Black Diamond. The Black Diamond is the thing that I can use. It's just very amusing to me. I mean, the whole character of Eclipso is kind of amusing to me. It's like, I have the Black Diamond. I have a Black Diamond. It's on the cover of my Eclipso Annual number 1, or Eclipso number 1. But anyway, and it totally kills my comic collection, but oh well. Page 6, Hal is a little melodramatic about the curse of Green Lantern not leaving him. And this might make sense if he didn't already know that Jon Stewart was Green Lantern now.
Right.
Exactly. Also on page 6, they call it the Murder Moon, which I really get a kick out of. With a name like that, I want one.
It's a great name for a mobile battle station.
Yeah, it's even better than Death Star when it comes down to it. Murder Moon. Because you have the MM, you have the alliteration, as it were. Yeah, exactly.
Although I just noticed on page 7, they've got the little, looks like a satellite type thing there on the side. So very clearly based off of the Death Star.
Yeah, it does appear to be very similar to a Death Star. But on page 10, as much as I wanted that Murder Moon, no, the Solar Jet, that's what I want. Wait, so the Solar Jet is going to disconnect Eclipso from Bruce Gordon because the technology can do it.
Huh?
This story has officially jumped the shark.
Which shark?
King Shark. No, the shark. But either way, regardless. Page 13. Okay, I'm not above calling the Predator cheesy. But let's face it, he doesn't stand a chance against Eclipso. It's like pitting Blue Beetle against Lobo. He's like, oh, well, now you have to face me. Really? Just you? That's all? On page 16, it would have been funnier if Davis just, like, crashed and blew up the jet. But then again, they're not going for humor, but I would have found it amusing. Regardless. Oh, jeez, on page 17, he died? That's a little lame. I kind of wish that he could have been held accountable for what he had actually done. But instead he's being held accountable by way of death.
Right.
Oh well. Page 19. I have no idea why Eclipso was able to break through his Green Lantern construct cell. Do you know the part that I'm talking about? Jon Stewart makes a cell for him to just be in.
Oh yeah, I noticed that.
And Eclipso was just able to break out for no reason.
I scratched my head on it, but then I didn't make a note about it. So I'm glad you brought it up. I don't know.
There's not really like a reason given, and there's nothing set up that would explain why he's able to just do that. Really, what it says is that his will is stronger than Jon Stewart's. And I don't know that I agree with that.
Or Jon got distracted by something.
Eh? That's what Jon Stewart says when Eclipso breaks out. Eh?
Eh?
If anything, he's distracted by the fact that Eclipso is able to break out.
Right.
But I would have liked some sort of explanation how it's like a hard light construct, so concentrated darkness that Eclipso is able to create can break through it. Just some sort of explanation, but we don't get anything. So what are you going to do? Page 20, right here, Eclipso says that he can't fly. So he'll finish off Stewart when they reach the ground. And so why doesn't Jon Stewart just keep him up in the air? If Eclipso can't do anything until they reach the ground, John Stewart should just be keeping him up in the air. He could just do like one of those, you know, ball on a string with a paddle things. Just keep him up in the air. If he can keep him up in the air, he's not a threat anymore.
But, I got nothing. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Page 21, this page is laid out wrong. It just doesn't make any sense. You go from panel 1 to panel 2 to panel 3. You go to the side panel on the right, and then back to the bottom two panels on the left-hand page. It's not laid out correctly.
Yeah, it doesn't flow. Yeah, if John's speech balloon would have been up above that, you know, where the three shorter panels end, it would have flowed a little better.
Yeah, but, and it just didn't flow well here. Or I mean, at least if they had put in those little arrows that they sometimes do, which usually indicate the right way to read a comic book to begin with. But I can take a look at this page, and I understand why my older sister doesn't know what order to read panels in. Because it's not correct here. And finally, the last page, page 23, I honestly did not know who this note was supposed to be from. You guys mentioned it's from the Predator, and that does make sense. So now, oh man, now I got to think who that note could be from. It's got to be somebody from Carol's past. There's a rose. I feel like I should know who it is, but I don't. I'm an idiot.
Well, we'll get to it. It's not. Okay. It's actually, I think, only maybe two episodes away.
Okay. I was going to say, yeah, it's very quick.
Three at the most.
So no listeners out there, don't go posting it on my page. Why didn't you know the Predator was this person?
You're not an idiot. It's just that odd.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that I'll end up kicking myself, but I'm content to not know until we get to it.
All right, well, this issue also has an advertisement for Crisis, or DC Universe Crisis on Infinite Earths, as the ad calls it. We see the Monitor satellite and a silhouette of who we know as the Monitor, and the text reads, "For the past 12 months, he has been monitoring the DC Universe, watching, waiting, scheming, and now you will find out why. DC Universe Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same." On the Meanwhile page, there's a section at the bottom that lists books on sale this particular week, and the blurb for this book, Green Lantern 186, says, "A new story begins, featuring the new GL in all-out action." So that just shows more of the scheduling oddities that I was talking about. I don't know how far in advance those Meanwhile pages were put together, but I don't imagine they were done too far ahead. I'm thinking the reprint in 184 was pretty last minute, because we had the comment last issue that 185 would be the book-length epic, which was Gibbon's swan song. So if this particular story was meant to be in 185, then that would have applied. Plus, 186 would have been the beginning of a new story.
I'm guessing that's what happened, but things were running a little bit late, so they did the fill-in story.
And that could also explain why the three-parter Chuck Patton was to do never materialized, because next issue is a fill-in team, and then we get the new regular creative team with 188.
Yeah, I actually had a sort of a note at the end. It looks like the next one will be another fill-in. But I do love both those creators, so I'm okay with that. I hope that it's going to be a good story.
And it's not a fill-in as far – not to spoil ahead, but it's not a fill-in as in, you know, you can take it out and it doesn't matter. It actually bridges the gap between Wayne's run and the next run.
Gotcha.
Forgetting the guy's name, right? Steve Englehart. It bridges those two runs together. But as far as letters this time, though, there were quite a few sharp remarks about John becoming Green Lantern in 182. Some people are happy about it, others not so much. But as I suspected, it seems that the switch did cause quite a stir, at least judging by the letters they printed in this issue. Anybody else got any comments about 186?
Well, I liked the issue up until Jeffrey pointed out all the implausibilities. I'm like, well, not as good as I thought it was.
Still, though, I think that Wayne and Gibbons went out on a high note.
Yeah.
Yeah, and impossibilities does not necessarily ruin an issue. I do feel the need to point them out.
Right.
But
well, it's our job as podcasters.
Exactly.
Well, there were no other appearances of Green Lantern in these 3 months. But out in December 1984 was Who's Who in the DC Universe number 1, There's really no Green Lantern-related profiles in that first issue, but as we get farther in, I'll be posting scans of the relevant entries on the website to help people, you know, get caught up on backstories of the characters that we're talking about and the Green Lantern's various rogues. Next episode, we'll be looking at Green Lantern 187, 188, and 189. Plus, we'll be taking a brief look at the first three issues of Crisis on Infinite Earths. Anybody else got anything?
How are we going to deal with the DC retroactive special?
That's going to be a special episode coming after episode 7.
Okay, so that's something people need to keep an eye out for.
Right. Yeah, that'll be... Let's see, this is they're hearing this in March, so that the retroactive special episode will be out in mid-April.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, until next time, my name is Michael Bradley.
I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am J. David Taylor.
We'll see you next time, guys.
Bye.
Folks.
Thanks for listening. Jeffrey Taylor. J. David Weider. Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Green Lantern's Light, hosted by Michael Bradley,
Jeffrey Taylor,
and J. David Weider. Show notes, past episodes, and other information about the show can be found at greenlanternslight.com. You can also subscribe to the show directly via the RSS feed and on iTunes.
If you'd like to get in touch with the show, drop us a line to greenlanternpodcast@gmail.com or use the contact form at the website. You can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter to get updates and interact with us directly. Let us know your thoughts, and we might even read your message on a future episode.
Green Lantern and all related elements are copyright DC Comics. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll come back next month. But until then...
In brightest day...
In blackest night...
No evil shall escape our sight.
Let those who worship evil's might...
Beware our power!
Green Lantern's light!
So that you could actually cut it off before before I said yes, that sounds good. Good segue. Didn't want to ruin it.
All right. So, David, you're doing 184, right?
I am indeed doing 184.
Okay.
Hey, off. No, sorry, I was talking to the cat. I'm sorry, guys. I thought I muted myself when I said that. You won't leave me alone.
Wow, Jeffrey really hates Guy Gardner.
Okay. Are you good to go, Jeffrey?
Sorry, guys.